When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to another between season mini episode of Origin Story. I'm Dorian Linsky.
And I'm Ian Dunt.
Normally we send these out to patrons only, but we're going to do a couple for everybody. And this one is going to be based on a book that I have out, Everything Must Go, The Stories We Tell About the End of the World, which is a history of narratives of the end of the world, both fiction and non-fiction, and how they feed into each other. And covers a lot of time. And Ian said, rather than going back to, you know, the Book of Revelation or the Zoroastrians, Ian suggested that I talk about the origin of the secular end of the world, which is this major intellectual break. I don't know if he suggested this because it includes the French Revolution.
Just for the record, you mention it a lot.
It was really important, Ian. I don't know if you know. It was quite the hubbub.
Just before you do it, can I just say, the bit in your book where you talk about the end of the world story in the Bible, I never knew just how batshit and elaborate that was. I never knew all the details. And, you know, there's a bit in the lake of fire and, you know, hundreds of years later, there's this and there's that. It was quite the work of lunacy, that bit. So it's a side point and really has nothing to do with what we're talking about here.
But it really does, because it is a weird, weird story. And even St. Augustine was just like, Revelation is really hard to follow. Like, he basically goes, even though it's called Revelation, it's very hard to follow. Because all this stuff keeps happening and it kind of repeats itself. So basically he's describing the same thing, but in different words. And you're like, well, is the beast Satan? No, he's not. Is the Antichrist Satan? No. They're like three separate entities that all kind of like work together. Like the Suicide Squad or something.
Right, right.
It's incredibly confusing and weird and scary. And it does seem quite odd that that became accepted as the grand finale for the entire Bible.
Yeah, really. Anyway, we're not going to talk about that today.
We're not going to talk about that. No, but basically for 1800 years, that is what the end of the world means in the Western imagination. And the crucial thing about Revelation is that you get Armageddon, followed by the millennium, which is 1,000 years of peace and wonderfulness on earth. Then another battle with Satan, who's back.
Which, by the way, it must be quite hard to chill out in the whole 1,000 years of peace on earth when you know
Satan's coming back.
Yeah.
But then when Satan comes back, he gets walloped again. And that is when they get out the Book of Judgment and the Book of Names, and they decide who is saved and who is damned. And that's when you actually get paradise forever and ever.
Right.
So what that meant...
Doesn't make a huge amount of sense, but yeah.
It doesn't narratively. Emotionally, it does. Because what it means is that the worse things are getting, the closer we are to Armageddon, and therefore the closest to the millennium. So once we get over the hump of, you know, kind of firestorms and whirlwinds and earthquakes and mass murder, you know, then things are going to be really good for 1,000 years. And this means that throughout the second millennium, you have various kind of doomsday cults and revolutionary movements that are trying to speed up the process. But obviously speeding up the process means horrendous violence.
Right.
So it's a very dangerous book. Mm. And there's lots of kind of fears of it inspiring all kinds of revolution and bloodshed. And then you start getting to the end of the 18th century, Enlightenment in full swing. And people start thinking beyond God. Because one thing that I wasn't fully aware of was that, you know, 17th century very important scientists like Newton and Halley were really trying to reconcile it with the Bible. So Newton was privately writing this very intense book about the Book of Revelation. He was absolutely obsessed with the apocalypse. and Voltaire went, he did that to console mankind for the great superiority he had over them in other respects.
It's a generous appraisal. Newton's such a funny one, right? Like whenever, obviously on the science bit, you're like, incredibly, beyond impressive, like the founder of everything. And then as soon as you hear anything about him that's not about science, you're like, oh, you monstrous, like son of a bitch. He's a complete lunatic outside of the one area where he was profoundly useful.
And there were other people around, like William Whiston, who was like really, really, really quite far out and destroyed his career by predicting the end of the world, which then didn't happen. But Halley, of comet fame, was also trying to kind of work out how a comet might have caused the deluge in Genesis. And there was a lot of people really struggling to work out exactly how old the Earth was. So there was precise dates given. Literally, it's like, well, the Earth started at like 7 a.m. on a Wednesday. And I'm not taking the piss like that, literally. It was literally that precise. So it's not as if science emerges and then people go, oh, we don't need religion anymore. Obviously, there's a huge period where science can only be understood in terms of how it clicks with biblical scripture. Mm-hmm. By the end of the 18th century, that is no longer the case, and you get people having a clearer sense of how old the Earth might be. I mean, they're still way out. It's not billions of years, but it's definitely not like a started on 7 a.m. on a Wednesday. Right. Right. So this is sort of breaking down. As you can, all these certainties breaking down, one is the French Revolution, and partly as a result of the French Revolution, the 1790s is the first time that the end of a century is considered really significant.
Like, oh, wow.
The end of, like, widely, that we're coming to some kind of climax. Like, the 90s are really important. And there's people always just talking about the future and the end of the world. So there's one Calvinist. Calvinists went into this. He goes, the present moment teems with these anticipations of futurity beyond the example of every former period, which in the language of the time is basically fuck this shit. Like, it sounds eloquent, but he's really quite angry about this. And then, so this political turmoil and a sense of like old things passing away and a new world coming into being, which is a quite apocalyptic sort of concept. You've also got these changes in science. So not long before the 1790s, you've got Thomas Jefferson, founding father, writes about these bones that have been discovered somewhere in America, and they resemble an elephant, but a massive elephant. And he's just going, well, creatures don't just disappear. There's no such thing as extinction. So this massive elephant must be out there somewhere in the sort of uncharted wilds of North America. Georges Cuvier, who's a young teacher at the Museum of Natural History in Paris, thinks that this is not the case. In 1796, he said the creature was not an elephant at all, but a species that completely disappeared. And eventually he decides to call this a mastodon. So he starts collecting fossils. He also discovers one which he calls the pterodactyl. And this really sort of changes people's conception of life on Earth, that you could have these, you know, these giant creatures that simply disappeared. And he claimed that the creatures he studied had been eradicated by some kind of catastrophe. And he said that the fossils in different strata of the Earth indicated that there'd been this series of violent upheavals, and each one wipes out the dominant species and makes way for the next. So life on Earth has been disturbed by terrible events. Living organisms without number have been the victims of these catastrophes. And this is called catastrophism, and repopularizes extinction. And actually, if you think about it, it's kind of a geological version of what was happening with the French Revolution. This catastrophe comes out, wipes out the old world, brings in the new.
And he's sort of right, right? You know, when you think of like the asteroid effect on the dinosaurs or...
Right, but we don't even know about the asteroid until the 1980s.
Oh, of course, of course.
But he's right.
He's quite prescient.
Yeah. So people are fascinated by him. They're also fascinated by the Comte de Buffon. Beautiful French on origin story.
No, I mean, this is a proud new tradition that we've started. And, you know, I think that was, I mean, obviously, I have a very educated sense of when someone's really mastering the French accent. And I think that you did terribly.
We had
well
a lot
there.
Of compliments on the left and right episode.
At some point, someone in the Patreon channel is actually going to comment on the content of that episode rather than my French accent.
Being going like, what is this francophobic hate crime Ian is committing? So there's another guy called Buffon who argued that the Earth had been created when a comet collided with the sun. It had been cooling down ever since, started off very hot, would therefore finally become a ball of ice. Now, at that time, poets and writers were really into science. Scientists were into poetry. It was this really sort of exciting time where you did not have that idea that came later of almost like the two cultures. It's like, are you doing STEM subjects or a useless English degree?
Right.
You know? So it's both. So the people reading Cuvier and Buffon include Lord Byron, Mary Shelley, and Percy Shelley. So Byron, actually, in his poem Don Juan, says, when this world shall be former, underground, thrown topsy-turvy, twisted, crisped, and curled, baked, fired, or burnt, turned inside out, or drowned, like all the worlds before, so Cuvier says. Literally a little hat tip to the man. And Shelley writes a letter about Buffon's sublime but gloomy theory. It's quite gloomy, in fact. The world would change into a lifeless ball of ice. And they're talking about this stuff because they've just become friends. So this is the summer of 1816. Byron has fled England in disgrace. His wife thinks he's mad. He's accused of an affair with his half-sister. Something, something mucky.
Is that the disgrace, or it was something else?
That was the main disgrace. But there was a lot. He was a superstar. He was like the most famous writer in England. But then his sort of sex life got him into scrapes.
Right.
So he escapes to the continent in a replica of Napoleon's carriage.
Wow. Because, are you serious?
Why not?
I mean, that's so Byron. That really is.
Which also he didn't pay for. He ordered it and then didn't pay for it. You've also got the Shelleys, who've got their own problems, because Shelley is at that point married, like estranged from his wife. He's married. His father certainly does not want him to marry Mary, Wollstonecraft at the time. Her family, her dad isn't crazy about it either. There's huge scandal because Shelley was the most famous atheist in Britain, almost like the first celebrity atheist. So there's quite a lot of hostility, and they settle down by Lake Geneva, which was a huge kind of magnet for English tourists. In fact, Byron gets there and complains that it's full of exactly the English people that he was trying to get away from.
The experience of all English tourists through the ages.
Exactly, exactly. So they're introduced by Claire Claremont, who Byron had made pregnant, and she was trying to get back with Byron. And she's traveling with the Shelleys, and she's just like, why don't we go and see Byron? She does not succeed in winning him back, but it does forge this really important friendship. So they're talking about Buffon, they're talking about Cuvier. They're also really fascinated by another idea which becomes really, really important after the French Revolution, which is ruins. And the idea that, you know, all things must pass, everything turns to dust, even, you know, all the greatest things. And Count Volney writes a book called The Ruins, or A Survey of the Revolutions of Empires. And he visits the ruins of Palmyra in Syria, which had been destroyed by the Romans. And it's very kind of, what glory is here eclipsed and how many labors annihilated? I know you don't like exclamation marks in text, so you would not enjoy this.
No, I can almost hear the exclamation mark bursting out of that page, actually.
Yes. Who, said I to myself, can assure me that the present desolation will not one day be the lot of our own country? Who knows but that hereafter some traveler like myself will sit down upon the banks of the Seine, the Thames, or the Zuider Zee, solitary amid silent ruins? So people get very excited about the idea of St. Paul's, which is the tallest building in London at the time, and, you know, the great capitals of Europe in ruins. People loved going to visit Pompeii and Herculaneum. They loved the ruins in Rome. That was part of the grand tour. So it's this sort of thing. On one hand, it's just like, it's a cool thing to go and see, but also that it sort of fed this idea of like, well, if it happened to them, could it happen to us? So there's always that weird mix that you get of like tremendous optimism about the future, and then also it's like, oh, is it all just going to fall apart?
That's so interesting. You never think of the Victorians in this way. You always think of them as these kind of can-do, we're going to make railways, we're going to build bridges, you know, like an optimistic kind of culture.
Well, I mean, we don't really have time to get into him, but the great sort of apocalyptic painter of that era, a little bit later on, is a guy called John Martin, who, you know, people may be familiar with, like, The Great Day of His Wrath, these incredible apocalyptic paintings. And he would do paintings of, like, all the big biblical catastrophes, but also the eruption of Vesuvius and stuff like that. But he was actually a really level-headed man who was like helping to work on like train system. thinking about the London Underground. Do you know what I mean? Was kind of like this apocalyptic thing and this pragmatic side, mm-hmm. which maybe sums up that era. And Shelley himself, of course, he writes Ozymandias, which is about, you know, ruined glory and vanity. And he also proposes that, you know, one day somebody shall stand and see the ruins of St. Paul's and Westminster Abbey. And the historian Thomas Macaulay comes up with the idea that it would be a traveller from New Zealand, which at that time was just like so far away. Right. And it was assumed that whatever happened to the rest of the world, New Zealand would be safe, which is weirdly what billionaire survivalists still think. And it actually became such a trope in the New Zealander that people, whenever they want to talk about the future, they're like, when the New Zealander comes along, that Punch magazine proposed banning all references to the New Zealander. And he goes, he can no longer be suffered to impede the traffic over London Bridge, may return when London is in ruins. So they're meeting up in the summer of 1816, which is known as the year without a summer. Mm-hmm. And this, not that anybody understood this at the time, this is because a year prior, in April 1815, a volcano on Sumbawa in Indonesia called Mount Tambora had erupted larger than Krakatoa, much more famous, came later. Krakatoa is basically more famous because the media was more advanced by then and people just found out about it quicker and science was more advanced. 100 times more powerful than Vesuvius. And this creates an aerosol cloud around the world of sulfuric acid droplets. And at first, in the summer, this is summer after Battle of Waterloo, it just creates these mad sunsets, which you can sometimes see in paintings by people like Turner, and like turns the snow pink. And there's these really weird effects of all this volcanic dust and sulfur in the atmosphere. But then as it progresses, you know, over that course of that year, it basically causes temporary climate change. It causes the global average temperature to drop significantly, creates the most insane weather. So in Boston, it goes from a heat wave to a snowstorm in a couple of days.
Oh, my God.
Like, nobody really knows what's going on.
No one at this point understands the cause.
No. No, like I searched the newspaper archives and people just weren't talking about Tambora at all. They had no idea that this was what was causing it.
I really do not blame them for thinking some very hysterical shit at this point, because I think I would be as well. No one could explain to me why summer wasn't coming and, you know, we were getting that kind of event. I think I might go a little bit funny as well.
And it leads actually to massive famines in the following year, civil unrest, you know. Things drown, this horrendous image of like the Lake Geneva kind of floods and consumes some of the surrounding farmland. And so basically it's just this floating soup of like dead cattle and
Jesus
trees.
Christ. You just went like sort of full Cronenberg on this though.
I know, right? Yeah, it was very macabre. So obviously what you get is religious prophets, many, many prophets going, well, this is the end of the world. One bold soul, this is Italian astronomer, literally goes, it's going to be the 18th of July, 1816.
Extremely precise.
Extremely precise. He came to regret that. I mean, partly
was that on the 17th of July?
Well, no, before then, because he was arrested for causing panic. Because the authorities were really like, oh, no, not this again, basically. They cracked down on that kind of thing. So it actually caused quite a lot of panic. The British Ladies magazine, which I think it's a shame that's not still around, says alarm and consternation pervade all ranks. Even those who affect to laugh at the prediction evidently feel its influence. All await the event with patient horror, though ashamed of openly avowing it. They are afraid of being laughed at if the event does not come to pass. Hmm. So it wasn't just, as the press often like to pretend, like the sort of the dumb peasants. Mm. There's quite a lot of people just like, well, things are really weird. Mm. It's raining all the time.
Yeah.
You know, there's storms, there's, you know, dark days. People talk about darkness at noon. It was very sort of hair-raising. So this is the context that you've got Byron and Shelley. They can't go out most of the time because it's raining all the time. And they're forging this friendship. Although Shelley writes home to one of his friends, Lord Byron is an exceedingly interesting person, and as such, is it not to be regretted that he is slave to the vilest and most vulgar prejudices and as mad as the winds? So it's like, it's a tentative friendship. It's a bit like, this guy is fascinating, but crazy. So one night in the middle of June, you've got Byron, Mary, Percy Shelley, John Polidori, who's Byron's sort of ambitious sidekick slash personal physician. And they're all just sitting around while it's the rain is sort of hammering the villa. And Byron says, we will all each write a ghost story. And this is obviously one of the most famous moments in literature because Mary Shelley, who's only 19 at the time, she goes off and writes Frankenstein. Does
not
rather well.
Not bad for a 19-year-old on a bet, basically.
not bad. She takes it seriously. Byron starts writing one about a vampire, but then can't be asked to finish it. So Polidori then goes off and writes The Vampire, which is the first vampire story in English fiction.
Fucking hell.
It's not great. It's not a great read, but it's, again, quite important. Mm. Byron, like I said, can't be really bothered to do the ghost story. But in July, around the time that the world is meant to end, he writes this poem called Darkness, which is sort of one of the most important poems ever written in terms of our understanding of the world. It's also very, very goth. Mm. So may I read a little bit?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Usually when people say, can I read poetry, my heart freezes in my chest, but I'm actually interested. I actually do want to hear that thing now.
I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to read like the heavy stuff. This is how it opens. He goes, I had a dream, which was not all a dream. The bright sun was extinguished, and the stars did wander darkling in the eternal space, rayless and pathless, and the icy earth swung blind and blackening in the moonless air. Morn came and went, and came and brought no day. So there's a bit of that Buffon idea of the icy earth. Mm. Then it goes on basically where, so the sun goes out, it's very dark, it's very cold. People burn down the world basically to keep warm, which turns out the problem with doing that is that then you just burn everything and then you're cold again and now you've got no stuff.
Right.
And then famine, and then they end up killing each other, and then everybody's dead.
That's okay. Right.
So he ends with, the world was void. The populous and the powerful was a lump, seasonless, herbless, treeless, manless, lifeless, a lump of death, a chaos of hard clay. And it goes on and on. The waves were dead. The tides were in their grave. The moon, their mistress, had expired before. The winds were withered in the stagnant air, and the clouds perished. Darkness had no need of aid from them. She was the universe. So it's like, oh, so there's no God and there's no paradise. It's just everything goes very, very badly wrong. Mm. Everybody dies, and then like the stars go out, essentially.
Jesus Christ.
So this was quite intense.
I love that you've spent 2 years reading this stuff, and you genuinely seem quite well-rounded now, I don't know how.
I'm quite chipper. Well, because compared to that, like you just...
I mean, the alternative was Rishi Sunak. So, I mean, really, what did you have?
Yeah. Also, like when you're looking at like this extremity and you're just like, oh, you know, oh, I've got too many podcasts to do. And it's like, well, at least the icy earth isn't swinging blind and blackening in the moonless air. Like, come on, you know, get in perspective. One reviewer goes, the very conception is terrible above all conception of known calamity and is too oppressive to the imagination to be contemplated with pleasure, even in the faint reflection of poetry. Mm. So the idea is that, like, you really should not be writing about the end of the world because it's like, it's too much, as Mary Shelley finds out. So Frankenstein is a massive hit. Mm. Obviously, the first science fiction novel, essentially, still shapes discussions about AI. It's any discussion about technology, basically, for the last 200 odd years, ends up invoking Frankenstein somewhere.
It's funny to think about it, right? Like, I mean, just the other day, I saw that trailer for the new Alien film. You think combination of sci-fi and the idea of inserting hubris into like the core of sci-fi.
Yeah.
So, and that's really what you find with films like that. You know, what's the core moral lesson in all Alien films is man's hubris. You know, what do you find again and again? It's not even just the terms. It's like the kind of the moral through line that so often occupies sci-fi, especially where it meets horror.
Yeah, yeah.
It sort of feels like it starts with her.
I mean, we could do a whole episode on Frankenstein, but we're not going to. Then Mary
Shelley...
are we? Who knows? Mary Shelley's life then becomes absolutely ghastly. 1818, two of her small children die of illness. Mm. 1821, John Polidori commits suicide. They weren't that close, but he was one of the sort of Lake Geneva crew. Mm. Percy Shelley drowns in 1822, and Byron dies in 1824 while fighting for Greece against the Ottoman Empire.
Jesus Christ.
Dies of illness. She writes in her journal just after Byron's death, "The last man, yes, I may well describe that solitary being's feelings, feeling myself as the last relic of a beloved race, my companions extinct before me."
Mm. Poor thing. How old was she at this point?
So 1824, right? You're still talking like mid-20s?
Jesus Christ. It's insane to think of that much loss when you're in your mid-20s, like your kids, your husband, your friends.
She's pretty much lost everyone. And she finds it very hard to write for quite a long time. And then she decides she's going to write a book called The Last Man, in which basically she is working through her grief, that all the major characters are based on Percy and Byron. And herself. The Last Man is really herself. It's also the first pandemic novel, because it's about a plague that sweeps through Asia and Europe, and that's what ends up basically killing everybody.
Sorry, but full stop, this is the first pandemic novel in the canon or whatever.
Well, Brian Aldiss, historian of science fiction, says the first science fiction novel is Frankenstein, the second one is The Last Man.
Jesus, wow.
So it's sort of like...
Wow.
It's like incredibly important. It's basically like the prose version of what Byron did with Darkness. I mean, it's not like a cracking read, but it's fascinating. It was very, very brave, very ahead of its time. And underpinning it all is this sense of personal loss, of kind of like her own grief feels like the end of the world. Mm. And she's basically kind of reenacting her losses by killing these characters based on her loved ones, but also the entire planet. Mm. And it's really fascinating, the stuff that she's writing about pandemics and how people respond to viruses. And you can imagine that these days that stuff resonates a little bit more. The critics hate it. I mean, unbelievably cruel, because the idea of The Last Man had been bobbing around a bit in religious terms. There'd been a little fad for Last Man stories, but they were all religious. So there really is quite a distinction. But at the time, the distinction wasn't necessarily that clear. Right. It's like, oh, it's another story called The Last Man. And a guy called Thomas Hood wrote a satirical poem called The Last Man. And Blackwood's magazine likes that one. And he goes, "Mr. Hood, alive to the ludicrous, has viewed The Last Man in his proper light. And had the verses been published 2 years ago, they surely would have saved Mrs. Shelley from the perpetration of her stupid cruelties. Mr. Hood's Last Man is, in our opinion, worth 50 of Byron's Darkness, a mere daub, and 500 of Mrs. Shelley's abortion."
Abortion? Oh, my Christ.
I mean, the misogyny is pretty wild. Right. And then the bit that really intrigued me is a review for the Monthly Review, which says that basically you should not write about the end of the world without God. Like, it is an awful thing to do. "The utmost efforts of thought are absolutely childish when they seek to fathom the abyss of ruin, to number the accumulation of disasters, to paint the dreadful conclusion which awaits that final scene. Every writer who has hitherto ventured on the theme has fallen infinitely beneath it. Mrs. Shelley, in following their example, has merely made herself ridiculous. The whole appears to us to be the offspring of a diseased imagination and of a most polluted taste."
Fuck me.
So the moral disapproval of this is enormous. And so it's almost like people don't really want to sort of write or think about these two works, Darkness and The Last Man, at the time. They kind of want to dismiss them. Even Byron's fans were like, "I don't really know what he was doing with this one."
Right. But did they treat him with as much spite as they treated her? And
no, because he had that reputation. Mm. I mean, you'd think she would have the reputation for Frankenstein.
Right.
But, I mean, misogyny is a huge part of it.
Okay.
People just seem very furious. And they basically buried the book, and it fell out of print for decades and decades. Huh. So... for decades afterwards, there is no end-of-the-world fiction to speak of. It doesn't really take off again until towards the end of the 19th century, which is a whole other story, because, again, it's a time of, like, people being very worried about sort of science and looming war and degeneration and all the things that could go wrong. So it's this sort of historical orphan, this novel that is influential in lots of Last Man fiction since and pandemic fiction and science fiction of all kinds. But at the time, it's just killed. And nobody is immediately inspired by it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I find really quite noble and also quite tragic, the idea that you have no sort of immediate literary descendants. It takes decades for people to go, maybe this isn't that bad. It doesn't get reprinted, I think, for over 100 years.
You've said... nothing positive for the last half an hour.
What?
I started with the end of the world, and then the Mary Shelley stuff is breaking my heart, basically. Because I'm presuming that off the basis of that, she just sort of... Did she consider herself a failure, or was she aware of any degree of success in her lifetime?
Well, she was aware of the success of Frankenstein, but she was very... She was very goth. If you read her diaries and her letters when she's talking about grief, there is no hiding it. It is so wild and unguarded, like how upset and depressed she is. And of course, she never has another book that is anything like the success of Frankenstein. Even Frankenstein, it's kind of like, it's hugely popular on stage, but in these kind of watered down versions. Right, right. It's not that there was ever a kind of big public vote of approval for her as a writer or as a person. And there's a tragic little sort of coda where quite a long time later, she returns to Lake Geneva and she just basically goes, everybody's dead.
Oh, Jesus.
So through this friendship, facilitated by Claire Claremont, who in fact lived till like her 80s or whatever. The person that nobody particularly liked lived for an insanely long time. But because of that, you get this kind of weird friendship, out of which comes Frankenstein, Ozymandias, some of Byron's poetry is influenced by these discussions, and two early versions of what, how do you write about the end of the world with no God, no paradise, no reward, no glorious transformation, literally just the end. And that what a radical and bold and unpopular idea that was. And of course, one that is entirely normalized now.
I mean, I feel, given that this is sort of like half episode, half promo, I feel that at this point I would usually sort of go like, if you want more of that, you should read Dorian. But I have to say, I think it's quite unlikely that someone listens to that and doesn't buy your book, because it is kind of like the immensity of the subject matter and just the sort of scope of the stuff that you're talking about is truly fascinating. And what I found odd about it as well is that I kept on sort of wondering why I wasn't more aware of this stuff, like as a set topic, right? Like you feel like you experience it, you know, whether it's Armageddon or whatever.
Yeah.
But I've never seen it subject to any kind of critical appraisal at all. Certainly not at this kind of magnitude and this depth and this scale.
Well, thanks, man. I hope people who listen to this podcast would get a lot out of it, because there are a lot of the similar ideas, I suppose, approaches of just tracking the meaning of certain words, certain tropes, how these things move through history, how we misunderstand sometimes a lot of what people are misunderstanding is what Frankenstein means or what the Battle of Armageddon means or whatever. So it's that same kind of process. So yes, there we go. That is, I hope you enjoyed that in its own right and not just for its unashamed promotional value.
Anyway, I mean, if the listeners of this podcast are not buying your book, you are completely fucked.
And patient backers can, of course, on certain tiers, get a signed copy if they like. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go, douse myself in warm water and try to think of thoughts of the sun emerging from behind the clouds.
See you soon.
Cheerio.